Okay. All right, well, there's nothing they can do right now. They've got themselves in such a mess over there. Hang on, we'll be on the air in just a minute. Yeah. Yes.
No, I'm not here until
then. Okay. Fine, we'll just bring that up. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Oh,
no, honey, that's okay. I'll be okay for a while. And if he doesn't get here, I can manage. Here he is. Yeah, just in the nick of time. Good.
Went to a Scottish Rite from Carmel Valley.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we're going to have a fascinating program this evening with Joan Vian, who's just back from the G8 meeting. That's a group of eight meeting that was held there in up the coast of Georgia on Sea Island. And we're going to give you some insight into what really happened there. Now, we are indeed fortunate that Joan does go to these international meetings and comes back and tells us what really happened, because so much of what you read in the newspaper just isn't true. What most people do not understand is what took place on the Mount of Temptation when our Lord was confronted by the devil, who said, if you'll just kneel down and worship me, I can give you all the kingdoms of the world. Now, how could the devil possibly make that offer unless he controlled the meetings of the nations of the world, the governments of the world? And I'd like to suggest to you that there truly is a spiritual battle going on, and the spiritual aspect of what takes place cannot be minimized in any way. In fact, at this meeting where the G8 met, and this these are the financial leaders of the eight major nations of the world, and of course Joan will cover all of that for us, but as Joan pointed out, there was a pentagram on the top of the table. There are strong occult overtones to everything going on. There is an elite that rules the world. Their goal is a one-world government. First of all, they're dividing the world into three major economic blocks, and then they will unite them. The first one, of course, is Europe, that now is going to cover about 450 million people. They're going to expand the United States to take in all of the Western Hemisphere. And then, of course, and there'll be a common currency, a common government, and common loss of freedom. And then, of course, the European area would appear to be right now centering around more Japan and its currency. Perhaps eventually it'll shift to China, which will be the great economic engine of the world. in 5 years, thanks to the fact that the American government is doing everything they can to encourage our industries to invest there, billions of dollars be invested there by American corporations and getting all sorts of tax breaks and incentives to take the jobs away from America and move them overseas. Because, you see, this is part of the demonic plan for the New World Order and the New World Religion. Well, down there at in Georgia at Sea Island, why the leaders of the world were there, and there were about 20,000 police and the National Guard and Army units. There were about 40 protesters, but they had to protect the elite. After all, we wouldn't want anything to happen to them. They had a big band down there to play for the demonstrators. About 40 people in the audience, a big empty field. Because people have this feeling of frustration. What can you do when the power is aligned against you? And that's really in many respects true unless you understand it is a spiritual battle. And then, of course, if we are on God's side, why, there's a great deal we can do. And part of it is to bring out the truth. And so with that as the background, Joan, why don't you tell us what you witnessed there at the G8 meeting? Because I know you actually talked to many of the leaders, as you have in the past, to gain information for our listeners across America.
I would like to first say that this is a ministry that I have. Nobody pays me to go to these meetings. I do it because I'm a concerned American. Without my report, the information that I'm going to give you this evening would not come out, or it would come out. It would come out in very coded language, and you would never know that the bottom line to what happened, something that was masked, it would have been masked anyway, but the funeral of President Reagan was very convenient, and there was very little that really came out about what happened at Sea Island. But I have to say that, in my opinion, it was one of the most powerful meetings. There was a fair amount accomplished. It was a very aggressive meeting. Over last year, the G8 leaders made 204 commitments. This year they made 245 commitments, an increase of over 20%. The American taxpayer is on the dole for literally billions of dollars that were committed by the Bush administration for a transfer of wealth.
And really it is a transfer of wealth from the middle class here in America to the rest of the world as we impoverish the American people. And where do they get off doing this? Without the consent of the Senate and the House of Representatives? Why, they just do it because they have the power.
That's right. And the group of eight this year, the bottom line to their deliberations is that we have seen this structure evolve over the 30 years that they've been meeting. Is the world better off from when they started meeting? No. Is there world peace? No. Is there anything that we should be happy about from when they started meeting? The answer is no. The G8 has evolved, and for people who are not familiar with the G8, let me name the countries that are members of the Group of Eight. The United States, and we are the ones who started this little meeting. The United States, Canada, Germany, Japan, Italy, France, Great Britain, and Russia became a working member in all areas except finance in 2002. Let me also point out that of the members of the G8, they were all allies or enemies during World War II, and furthermore, they were not only allies or enemies during World War II, but of the G8 members, four of them are permanent Security Council members, and China is the fifth permanent Security Council member. China is not a member at this moment of the Group of Eight. That is something that will be worked on in the future, and I believe it is the intent of Tony Blair, who will be president next year. By the way, every year there's an evolving presidency, just like you see in the European Union. And last year it was France, this year it was the U.S. It just concluded and passed on to the British with George Bush concluding the G8 meeting last week. And after the British, it will be Russia for the first time. Now, if that's not an interesting contemplation, that Russia will be the president of the G8 in 2005.
Well, I think that most people believe, you know, the Russia's on, the communism's on one side, and of course capitalism's on the other. They don't understand it's all a power play. We've financed the Russians, the communists, going back to 1918, and anybody who hasn't read my book, I really needed to get that, or Professor Sutton's excellent books on the financing of Russia, Wall Street, and the rise of and the Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street and the rise of Hitler, and certainly Professor Sutton's last book, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. It's all smoke and mirrors, but we can't let the American people know that. We have to really think that there really is this conflict between America and Russia. But we play footsie with them all the time, and we are still financing them as we have since 1918 under one guise or another. Just read your Wall Street Journal, and you'll always find out how we're always finding another excuse to pour money in to keep their economy going, their faltering economy.
Oh, I would say on that note, with regard to financing Russia, there was a new initiative on the non-proliferation of weapons, and this year Russia joined, and you know, we'll be pouring into that endeavor $10 billion alone.
And of course, Russia's in full military production for war, as is in communist China, and the United States is unilaterally disarming. The president has announced we're going to do away with half of our nuclear warheads here, you know, in the, by the year 2010. Why would we be doing something like that when Russia is preparing for war and we're unilaterally disarming? Just doesn't seem to really make sense.
No, it doesn't, and neither does the whole purpose of the Group of Eight. They have evolved as a global board of directors with a global cabinet. Throughout the year, all of the G8 energy ministers, the G8 education ministers, the G8 foreign ministers, the G8 trade ministers, the G8 education ministers, the G8 transportation, labor, you can take a look at every position of President Bush's cabinet, and for every position, the G8 cabinet level is meeting throughout the year. They are issuing their own directives as to the integration of our countries, not only from a G8 perspective, but from a global perspective. When we take a look at the events surrounding the original meeting of the Group of Eight, that was in 1973. They began their first formal meeting in 1975. America was involved in the oil embargo as a result of war in the Middle East. Energy rose from $2.50 a barrel to $11. Inflation climbed to 11%. Interest rates were 12. Unemployment was 9. And our federal deficits were $70 billion. Today, interestingly enough, we still have war in the Middle East. We have war in Iraq. We have the war on terror, besides a proliferation of wars throughout Africa. We have oil, which rose to $42 a barrel a week or so ago. Now it's down to $35 a barrel, same price as the end of 1979, when oil, we went into the second phase of the destabilization of the Middle East through the fall of the Shah of Iran. We have inflation at 1%, if you believe that, and that's only because they've reconfigured how you figure out inflation, and it's no longer the cost of home ownership. And for anybody who's bought a home recently, they know that homes in the last 3 to 5 years have at least doubled, depending on where you live, if not tripled.
Well, of course, Joan, what they've done is they've taken housing, they've taken the cost of fuel, they've taken the price of food out of it, and then they say, see, there's no inflation. Well, the inflation rate's running about 8%, and people who are very close to Alan Greenspan have confirmed that he admits that, but they keep lying to the American people because, well, that's really what it's all about. With that old adage, are you going to believe us from the government who are here to help you, or are you going to believe your lying eyes that tell you inflation is going up? But of course it really isn't. You can trust us because we wouldn't lie to you. And of course they are lying to us about inflation. They're lying to us about their planned program to destroy the value of the American dollar and destroy the savings of the American people. Their plan, of course, to ship our jobs and factories overseas. So, but they can't let the American people do that, so they have to keep our attention focused on Iraq and this coming up election in November when we vote for skull and bones members 1 one or skull and bones number two, it really doesn't matter which, because they'll both continue exactly the same policies all the time. They keep arguing back and forth, like Amos and Andy, Laurel and Hardy, Lewis and Martin, or Abbott and Costello. But it's a great show, and most of the people in America really believe it's for real.
It's pretty sad. And let me just mention that the federal deficits today are over $7 trillion versus $70 billion. So from a standpoint of any kind of stability, it looks like the Group of Eight has destabilized the world, especially since there are no barriers, political, economic, trade, legal, intelligence, or military, anymore between the nation states. And as you so aptly pointed out, both our manufacturing and our white-collar jobs are being transferred to China and India, respectively.
And, of course, they've planned that the real plan is that India, China, Brazil, Russia will become the great industrial centers of the world as America, of course, begins moving towards its second world nation. It's not happening by accident. It's happening by intent. It's part of the great plan laid out in the Earth Charter by Gorbachev and Strong, and of course by that great paragon of virtue, Professor Stephen Rockefeller, where they talk about transferring the wealth between nations. That's point 10 of the Earth Charter. Transferring the wealth between nations. If you haven't read the Earth Charter and you're out in the audience, you'd like to get a copy, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send it to you. Of course, you can get that in the Sustainable Development Syllabus, but pick up the story, Joan, because it's so important that people understand that everything that's going on is being controlled by this small group of elitists who really believe in this idea of a new world order, a new world religion.
Well, I think for anybody who thinks you and I are crazy, Dr. Stan, two of the most powerful goals that the Group of Eight put in action this past week were, number one, a rapid deployment force for the world. Now, in 2000, at the United Nations Millennium Summit, the United Nations was given the go-ahead to have a rapid deployment force of 42,000 people.
In fact, that was laid out in a report by a man named Brahimi, who is most people have never heard of. But, of course, when President Bush was asked at a recent press conference who he was going to turn power over to on the 30th of June, he said, we're waiting for Mr. Brahimi to tell us. Brahimi, of course, is a UN flunky that had come up with a plan for this sort of rapid deployment force. And we have the Brahimi report in our Millennium Summit syllabus, which is available from Radio Liberty, going back to the year 2000, out of the Millennium Summit, which I'm sure you attended.
Yes, I was there. And so we have a situation whereby using the guise of Africa, using the fact that Africa is involved in so many wars, the fact that the G8 has invited African leaders to this elitist ball game in the last couple years, they basically concluded that they needed a peacekeeping force to help African countries who don't have the wherewithal, who don't have the equipment, who don't have the ability to mobilize forces to protect them when they are involved in a war. Now, Dr. Stan, you lived in South Africa, and I'm sure you know what a ruse this is, because the bottom line is there's a major fight for the assets of Africa, because Africa itself is very, very wealthy with diamonds and gold and strategic metals and manganese, as well as forests and agriculture.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it's really one of the most wealthy countries in the world. But, of course, what are we going to do with it? There's a great deal of social unrest. We've installed a communist dictator in Rhodesia. His name is Mugabe. We put him there. The United States insisted it. We have a communist government in South Africa under Mbeki, and certainly we have a communist government in Southwest Africa. We have a communist government in Angola that's being financed by Chevron Oil Company. But the average American can't accept that. Why, we would never put a communist government in power. And I would like to suggest, if you read the history and study the history of this last century, you'll find that time and again, from 1918 on, we installed communist governments throughout the world that would go along with our program of the New World Order, and those that didn't, why, of course, they end up like Allende did in Chile, or certainly like so many of the other communist dictators, Patrice Lumumba in Africa, who wouldn't go along with our program.
So we have a situation whereby, using Africa as the ruse, the Group of Eight, and it was pushed by President Bush, basically recommended that what they needed was a peacekeeping force in Africa of 75,000 troops. When they first had the press briefing on Tuesday, it was 50,000 troops, and by the close of the press briefing, the final press briefing by Bush on Thursday, it had grown to 75,000 troops. It was also reported that the Bush administration has already gone to Congress, and Congress has already told them that they would give them $660 million towards the American portion of the peacekeeping forces.
But, of course, you can't have a world government. You have to have a world army. You have to have a world court. You have to have a legislature. You have an executive. That would be Kofi Annan. And, of course, everything is in place. The only thing they need now is to get their taxation going, or simply get more money from the American people. And what we have to understand is that the United States is the major force behind this whole move towards world government. We pick up 25% of the tab for the United Nations. And, of course, we finance most of these meetings wherever they're held, and bring the politicians in. The average individual throughout the world doesn't want a world government, but the elite do, because they march to a different drumbeat. They dream a different dream. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Joan Vian, that will develop these ideas of what this is really all about, how rapidly things are moving towards the creation of this one world order that will be ruled by a new one world ruler. I believe it's going to be the Antichrist. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course our guest is Joan Vian. You pick up the story from there.
Let me just say, with regard to the peacekeeping force, that back several years ago at the United Nations Millennium Summit, it talked about the fact that a peacekeeping force would have a logistics center that would filter all of the requests for peacekeepers, and that logistics center would then be responsible for assigning various military as well as figuring out where they were going to get the all of the equipment and the different things necessary to mobilize the force. Well, it just so happens that logistics center is located in Italy, and that it is currently a United Nations logistics center. With regard to whose authorization these forces are going to be under, it was made very clearly that once the United Nations resolution was passed to use peacekeepers, that they would then be under the United Nations. So, surprise, surprise, this basically constitutes a global army for the world, and initially it will be 75,000 troops by 2010.
All right, fine. Now, what about the troops for to help out in Iraq? Because one of the big problems we have is that we're in a quagmire over there. We're in a tar pit, and of course, as long as the United Nations forces are there, why the Iraqis are going to resent the occupation? Many of them are going to die overthrow what they believe are the return of the Crusaders into the Holy Land of Iraq. So, you know, we're sort of in a no-win situation. So we're trying to get the NATO or somebody else to come in. Is there any support for NATO or the United Nations Army to help get us out of Iraq? Or do we really want them to be there? After all, we're building four massive new bases over there. Seems difficult to believe we'd be building all these bases if we really intended to pull out, as we say we intend to do.
Obviously, and when you take a look at the Iraqi-backed coalition, obviously everybody knows they're a puppet regime, and that's not going to go over very well when supposedly they take over the end of this month. There was a lot of arguing over Iraq. There was a lot of arguing over a number of initiatives regarding Iraq. The big thing was the NATO peacekeepers that George Bush wants. That has not been firmly resolved. There is opposition by Jacques Chirac. And as President Bush pointed out, that currently 15 of the 26 NATO countries have troops in Iraq already. There was also discussion over writing down debt in Iraq, Iraqi debt relief of $120 billion. And the question was, should they write down 50% or should they write down 90%? I think Jacques Chirac is a pretty smart guy. Now, he's a globalist and he's a socialist through and through, but overall, I think he's got some reasonable thinking, and he basically pointed out Bush wanted 90%, and he pointed out, how can we do that when there are so many highly indebted poor countries who, you know, we're not writing down 90% of their debt, and it would be unfair.
But, of course, the thing is, one reason Chirac is so concerned is because they had been lending Iraq a great deal of money in violation of the U.N. embargo. They had been violating the U.N.'s rules and regulations. The reason they opposed this going in was primarily because they had a good deal going with Saddam Hussein, and they were on the take from him. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Joan Vian, and we're talking about the discussion over on Sea Island by the G8 leaders, the financial and administrative executive leaders of the world, talking about what we were going to do with Iraq. And, of course, Joan was saying that many of the people, at least in the United States, wanted the other countries of the world to write off 90% of the debt that was owed to them. That's a lot of money, unless you understand that the banking system creates money out of nothing, so it's really all a paper transaction. But the French were really opposing that because, of course, I believe, because Iraq owes France so much money, they don't want to write off all the money that's owed to them. They don't mind other people writing off that debt, but they don't want to write that off, and we don't have that much debt owed by Iraq. And yet, of course, what we want, of course, is to have everybody write off the debt so we can control the oil, so that, of course, will not be used to pay off the debts. Pick up the story there, Joan.
Let me just make mention, when we talk about Iraq, we talk about the prices of oil. If the oil prices stay high, it could generate between $40 to $50 billion a year for Iraq versus the current $20 billion. So I find it fascinating that as we look at the Middle East, as we look at the high prices of oil, and I know that there's been a discussion that oil prices have reached, gas prices have reached their high and they're on their way down. I think that remains to be seen. But the bottom line is, they can manipulate, whether it's commodity prices, whether it's inflation, whether it's interest rates. The bottom line is, there's not anything economic that is really left to its own accord in today's world.
Well, of course, Bob Woodward, in his latest book, The Plan of Attack, said that he'd talked to Saudi and other oil country executives who said that they had promised Bush to get the price of oil down before the election so he'd look better. Of course, the Bush administration said, "Why, we would never done it, things like that." It is interesting that, in the face of having somebody blew up the Iraqi pipelines today, and their output is going to be down 50%, that the price of oil is dropping. Could it be that it's all manipulated, and could it be that Bob Woodward is really telling the truth, and that this is manipulated to help George Bush get reelected? Is it possible that things would be that crashed? And well, we'll just have to wait and see what happens. But one of the things that really disturbs me is that 13 months after the war ended in Iraq, we still haven't been able to get the electricity going over there. And this is one of the big complaints of the people. They think the Americans are intentionally not getting the electricity going to create the unrest and the continuing revolution. I mean, here in the United States, when the electricity is off for a day or two, we pull out all the stops, and it doesn't matter if half the country is shut down, we get the electricity going. Over there, after 13 months, the electricity will be a few hours a day. How could we do such a poor job unintentionally?
Maybe the bottom line is we haven't done such a poor job intentionally.
Or unintentionally.
Intentionally or unintentionally. you know, it's pretty sad that I know that a year ago when I was at the World Economic Forum, we were the scum of the world, and rightly so, for what we did to Iraq. And of course, I certainly was against what we have done in Iraq, but I think it brings up a very serious shift in national sovereignty. And again, Henry Kissinger a couple of years ago wrote a book about failed states. And what you're hearing increasingly is the need to change the Charter of the United Nations, because at this point the Charter of the United Nations does not allow it to transcend into a sovereign state that has failed. And so there is discussion that there has to be a greater mobility to protect people versus the sovereignty of a country. And I find that, especially going into Iraq, I find that absolutely scary, because then that means that now that they have that they are in the process, you know, how do we know? They could already have it set up. This global rapid deployment force, that it could be deployed anywhere, anytime, for any reason.
Well, it could even be deployed in the United States if we had civilian unrest here and all of our troops were overseas involved in two or three other wars. But don't worry, the United Nations could always send its troops in here. But would we really want to have the kind, compassion of the United Nations forces? Those of you who don't remember what the rape and pillage in Katanga back in the 1960s carried out by the United Nations forces, well, we're in real trouble, ladies and gentlemen, because we're relinquishing our sovereignty. We're doing exactly what George Washington advised us not to do, meddling in other people's affairs, which Samuel Huntington advised against in his classic book, The Clash of Civilizations, written in 1996. The professor of history at Harvard University, Samuel Huntington, said, never get involved in a war in the Middle East. Never try to impose your values on them, especially when they don't want them. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and one of the things that really disturbs me so deeply is that there are so many good people in America who think that it's all right for us to have a preemptive war to strike because, well, we have weapons of mass destruction. Well, maybe we didn't have weapons of mass destruction, but Saddam Hussein wasn't a very nice guy. Well, maybe we did keep Saddam Hussein in power and finance him all during the 1980s, but we didn't finance him after the 1990s, or did we? And if you haven't read Robert Baer's excellent book, See No Evil, he was the senior CIA operative in Iraq. In the 1990s, he will tell you how everybody he met in Iraq believed that Saddam Hussein had worked for the CIA, and many people he still worked for the CIA, and the American government was keeping him in power, and every time the Iraqi military tried to overthrow Saddam, America intervened and betrayed them. Now, you're not going to hear that from Rush Limbaugh, but the book See No Evil by Robert Baer is available through Radio Liberty. You need to check the facts out and find if perhaps most of what we're getting from the controlled media is simply smokes and mirrors, symbolism over substance. Go ahead, Joan, and let's pick up the story from there. And, of course, you are concerned about this UN rapid deployment force. And then, of course, will this be used in Iraq to help relieve the American troops from having to do what they should not train to do? And that is simple police work. We never should have disbanded the Iraqi army. We never should have disbanded the Iraqi police force. We created the state for chaos over there. There's no way they could have done that. Such a stupid thing unintentionally.
Yes, especially since we are so brilliant and we're so sure of ourselves that we could contain and subdue the people through the method of attack that they used, shock and awe. I know our time is slipping, Dr. Stan. Let me go on to global taxation.
Okay, I think that's important.
Global taxation is a topic that has... actually, it got me started covering these meetings. It has been 10 years that I have watched and monitored, that I have followed the concept of global taxation. 10 years ago, in a UN document called United Nations Development Program, UNDP Human Development Report, 1994, is where the United Nations said, You know, there are ways that we can tax the world. We can tax the control of arms. We can tax airline tickets. We can tax CO2 carbon per emissions. We can tax the transfer of money between countries, which is called the Tobin tax. And so we can raise trillions of dollars for the benefit of the United Nations through various forms of global taxation.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Okay, our guest, of course, this evening is Joan Vian. She's talking about how they're trying to raise taxes for the United Nations because any sovereign government has to have the ability to tax. And she mentions, of course, they were talking about the Tobin tax, a transfer of money between nations and taxing airline tickets and taxing carbon emissions. And all of these things are ways that they're trying to raise money for the bureaucracy. They live pretty well. But, of course, they really want to have their world government, and they have to have taxing ability. So what are the latest ideas by which they're going to fleece the people to get them to have the money so that the United Nations can forge the chains for the people of the world?
I don't know what the latest recommendations are. They're coming. I would say this, though, that the various methods of taxation that we both mentioned are still around and alive. And 2 months ago, when I was at the IMF World Bank meeting, they were in a very important report talking about different aspects of globalism and how they were going to tax the world. However, at this meeting, it was President Jacques Chirac who put global taxation on the agenda. And it's not just global taxation for global taxation. It is global taxation specifically to help the United Nations reduce poverty and feed the poor of the world. And so that, again, was a goal of the United Nations in 2000 at the Millennium Summit, and it has been refined, this goal. And so, therefore, that the United Nations needs a global tax in order to meet all these UN Millennium Development Goals.
And really helping the people of the world. Well, we saw how the United Nations and the Iraq Food for Oil program helped the people of the world as they siphoned off tens of billions of dollars for relatives of Kofi Annan, for executives and members of the Chirac's cabinet, and people in Germany. And fortunately, Saddam kept good records of all the payoffs he made, and always going to be so embarrassing for all these people when that information comes out. Or maybe we'll just suppress that, so we'll have something on all these internationalists, that we can use against them if they don't vote the way we want towards the New World Order, the New World Religion. But they actually siphoned off about $20 billion, something like that, from Saddam Hussein by buying special favors all throughout the world when that money was supposed to go to help the poor people and the children of Iraq.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the whole story of the UN. I mean, nobody's watching the UN. Nobody has any kind of regulation over the UN to see that the food, the money, the materials that are supposed to get where they're supposed to go are getting there versus in somebody's bank account. Anyway, with regard to global taxation, I think what is important to note is that President Chirac put it on the agenda. He put it on the table. He is backed by Tony Blair. Both the British and the French have set up a working group, which is in the process of meeting and determining new ways that they can have global taxation. And this new form of global taxation will be fair and equitable to all countries. So, for example, the high French official that I talked to said currently, the bottom line is the Tobin tax wouldn't work because it's just not economically sound. She said that a tax on emissions, CO2 emissions, wouldn't work because not all countries have that problem. So the British and the French are coming up with new innovative ways, and sometime this fall we can look forward to these new glorious ways of global taxation.
Well, of course, one of the is the methods is the Law of the Sea Treaty. Now, of course, the Senate, fortunately, has not gone along with that, but that would give the United Nations a wonderful opportunity to raise tremendous tax and, of course, be one more a nail in the coffin of our sovereignty as an individual nation.
Well, I would have to say that there was a very interesting workshop done by NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. And as part of that program, there was a Dr. Jim Connaughton, who is the White House chair on the White House chair on the Council on environmental quality. And so I asked him a couple of questions about the Law of the Sea. He doesn't know anything about the enterprise or the money-making venture of the Law of the Sea, which I found fascinating. And the bottom line is, he told me in a direct quote, the U.S. government has actually been implementing nearly every chapter of the Law of the Sea since it was first adopted.
And, of course, the tragedy is that the Senate has turned this down, refused to ratify it, but it doesn't matter what the Senate does. They're simply figureheads. The elite go ahead and simply implement the policies they want to, irrespective of the feelings of our elected representatives. The same thing happened with the Biodiversity Treaty, which the Senate had actually voted down, and it's been implemented. The same thing happened with the Kyoto Protocol, and that is being gradually implemented. And, of course, they did pass the Desertification Treaty because nobody in the Senate knew what they were voting on, and they voted unanimously to turn 70% of the arable land here in the United States over to the United Nations for planning control. Now, that means the United Nations then can tell the local state or the local planning commission what to do with it. The United Nations doesn't tell you what to do. They tell the planning commission to tell you what to do. And the average American has no idea how this is all being implemented step by step as we lose our sovereignty and move from freedom to global fascism. Well, before we go any further, though, Joan, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, how they can get in touch with your ministry, and how, if they're interested in the money management program that you have, how they could reach you as a client if they were interested.
First of all, the Women's International Media Group is a ministry, so I wear two hats. The Women's International Media Group has available newsletters, videotapes, audio tapes, and other materials. For people who are interested, they can call for an information packet, 301-371-0541, 301-371-0541. Without your support, without your donations, without your purchase of our various materials, just like Dr. Stan can't be on the radio, I can't go to these meetings. It's that simple. With regard to Vion Financial Services, and you might be saying, well, hey, I mean, you know, why do I have to give anything? You make a living. Yes, I do. But I have sacrificed my practice in order to take time and energy to go to these meetings. So therefore, I rely on people who are looking for an honest advisor, somebody who understands global trends, and that is through Vion Financial Services. That number, if you are interested in talking to me, is 301-371-0540, 301-371-0540. I write an economic newsletter. It comes out quarterly, as well as I mentioned, there's a newsletter through UN, the women's group called UN Watch.
Okay, fine. And is there a website at all?
Oh, I almost forgot.
Oh.
Womensgroup.org, WOMENSGROUP, womensgroup.org.
Womensgroup.org, okay. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Joan, why, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But Joan goes and rubs shoulders with the captains of the kings who rule the world, and of course it's all controlled through the financial manipulation. Those who control the money control the economy, those who control the economy control the governments, and those who control the governments control the populations, and that's how it works. If you doubt that, the wonderful book written by Professor Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, so well done and so revealing that somebody came in and bought up the plates, bought up the publisher Macmillan and destroyed the plates to the first half of the book, so it couldn't be reprinted. We have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells that story. It's called The Secret Government Four-Tape Set. But on page 324 of the book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, Professor Quigley explained how the system works, where the central banks, of course, hold regular secret meetings and lay out a secret plan. Their goal is to establish a feudalistic system throughout the world under their control, controlling the governments, controlling the populations, and, of course, controlling the politicians, as Professor Quigley says, by offering lucrative positions after they leave government. That's how the system really works. Page 324 of Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, which is available, incidentally. Now it has been finally reprinted, and it's a long story. Have we got it? Well, what are some of the other things you learned there at the Group of Eight meeting, Joan?
Well, there's no secret about travel plans and something they call secure and facilitated international travel, whereby currently any visitor to the United States coming in is being photographed and fingerprinted. And the G8 is looking to implement that as a reciprocal thing for all of the other G8 countries and initially a global concept. But furthermore, they are in the process of setting up a program whereby they can get online, real-time information on suspected travelers and facilitating real-time sharing of information on lost and stolen passports. Furthermore, they are looking to establish methodologies for assessing port security. And lastly, they are expanding research and collaboration on various biometric technologies for passenger control.
And I think what people have to understand is this whole scam of the terrorist threat is being used to justify establishing a police state. Now, if there was really a terrorist threat here in America, if there really was, and the terrorists were here and they're ready to bomb us at any time, don't you think we would have had at least one major bombing since September 11th? Don't you think that they were really concerned they would have closed our borders? Don't you think if they were really concerned, they would have insisted on every pilot being armed instead of blocking that, or really at reinforcing the cockpit doors, or having marshals on every plane, or having those deflectors on the planes in case somebody had a surface-to-air missile. Isn't it amazing with all the surface-to-air missiles in the world that the Al-Qaeda and wicked Osama bin Laden could get a hold of that they haven't shot down any of our planes here? Does that is there any question in your mind? If you saw the 60-minute program last Sunday evening where they talked about how all of our chemical plants, you could hit any one of them, even shoot a hole in one of those big tanks containing ammonia or chlorine, with a 50 caliber gun and blow them up and poison millions of people, that we've never had one attack and none of those chemical plants or factories are really guarded. Are we really fighting a war against terrorism, or is it all perception? Is this being used to justify establishing a police state? Who funded Osama bin Laden? Well, you'll want to get my latest newsletter if you really want to understand what this is all about. But, Joan, let's get back to this issue. Of course, what they really want to do then is be able to control international travel, and in the name of protecting us from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who used to work for the CIA, and many people believe he still does, we're going to lose freedom not only here but throughout the world.
Well, yes, and unfortunately, Dr. Stan, as you know, most Americans are so dumbed down that they listen to programs like ours and they think that you and I have lost our marbles, when, in fact, our marbles are still moving and theirs have become jelly.
No, they've been taking too much fluoridated water, and anybody who doesn't believe fluoridated water really does have a toxic effect on your mind, and the government knows it. Really, you need to get our four tapes out on fluoridation. And, of course, they know the hazardous effects of the mercury. And the influenza vaccines that they tell you you've just got to take, and yet it produces Alzheimer's disease. They know all these things. But they don't want a smart population. They want a compliant population.
So really, it's I know I'm supposed to be the guest, but let me ask you this question. So it's really influenza that does Alzheimer's?
Well, it's just part of it. Basically, there's a great deal of evidence that shows that much of Alzheimer's disease is related to mercury intoxication. Now, the influenza vaccine that they insist everybody takes has a very toxic dose. It's a prohibitively toxic dose, even for older people, but for the children they give it to, it is really, you're talking 50 to 70 times the dose of mercury that is allowed by the EPA. But the NIH and the CDC go and say, go ahead and get it, even though they know the vaccine isn't going to work because it's for the wrong organisms. But one of the biggest causes of Alzheimer's disease is the mercury in your fillings. And if you have mercury in your fillings, why, I would give serious consideration to getting our four tapes out. Or I'll tell you what, if you are concerned about it, you give me a call off the air and I'll get you a copy of our four tapes set on just on mercury and the scientific evidence that ties this to Alzheimer's disease. And the reason that you're not hearing this is because, of course, there's too much vested interest in continuing as we are. And then there are some people who feel there are too many people in the world today, and we really would be better off without so many people.
The bottom line is that we are talking spiritual warfare.
You're absolutely right.
This is so evil, so heinous.
Yeah. Well, but then if you believe in the Bible, you know we're involved in a spiritual battle, and there really are evil and wicked people. We're told in the Bible that the very heart of man is evil.
Absolutely. The very heart of man is evil. And really, that's what we've been talking about this whole program. Is the evil in man's heart. Any old excuse will do, if you will. We were talking about the G8 progress. One of the big key issues and center points of the Bush presidency, if you will, for the G8, was the Greater Middle East Plan. And Bush did invite a number of countries from the Middle East. There were some that didn't want to come, some that were hesitant, but the countries who came included Iraq, Egypt, Lebanon, Morocco, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Yemen, and Pakistan. And Bush led the G8 in establishing a historic, and I love all these phraseologies, partnership for progress and a common future in the Middle East. And what they set up was that in the future, the G8, there will be a forum in which the G8 and regional ministers from the Middle East, foreign and economic ministers from the specific countries, will meet with the G8 for regular discussions to reform the Middle East along with businesses and non-governmental organizations.
What we're really going to do is reform the Middle East, force our way of life on them. In the name of democracy, we're going to install dictatorships, and they'll, of course, be able to vote for which of the two candidates that we control that we run in their country. But they'll call it democracy as long as, of course, people cast the vote. Having forgotten that America was established not as a democracy, but as a republic, and James Madison said so well in the 10th of the Federalist Papers, which are never taught in our schools today, democracies are rare spectacles of turbulence and contention, are incompatible with the rights of personal liberty and private property, and are usually as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. Isn't it interesting we never teach that in college today, or in high school or grammar school? Isn't it interesting that our founding fathers wanted a republic, and yet we want to establish a democracy over in Iraq and in Saudi Arabia and in Syria and in Lebanon? And we want to remake the face of the Middle East. We want to bring democracy. Why would we want to be democracy when America is a republic? And if you look at the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence and the Federalist Papers, you'll never see any talk of democracy other than to say, we don't want a democracy because democracies always end up in dictatorship. Well, you're just about out of time, Joan. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
Well, my parting thoughts are that we need to be ready, we need to be built up, we need to be knowledgeable, and we need to be able to give every man an answer for why we are and what we should be doing. Furthermore, I think we need to understand that the days we live in are evil and that it is only a closer personal relationship with God through His Son, Jesus Christ, that is going to give us discernment and wisdom and understanding for such a time as this.
That's beautifully said, Joan, and that's really what it's all about. And for our listening audience out there, remember what Joan said. This is a spiritual battle that's being fought on the political and ideological and cultural and economic and battlefield. And most people don't even know the battle's going on. Most people think everything's going to be fine. And there's no incidents in all history where a nation such as ours has turned its back on God and that nation has survived. And believe me, God is going to bring his wrath upon this country. If there's not a great revival, if we don't find the people, the leaders who are willing to take a stand for righteousness, and I look across the country today, and they're few and far between. Well, Joan, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you here. And let's get that telephone number and website out just one more time so people will know how to get in touch with you.
The phone number is 301-371-0541. The website is womensgroup.org.
And, of course, what Joan does is so vitally important because there's nobody else in the country who's going to all of these meetings Joan's been to. How many meetings now?
63.
63 meetings she's had to pay, and it's an expensive thing, and living in hotels and being away from her family. But she does this because she believes it's so important that we have the information. God has called her to do this, just as I believe God's called me to do what I'm doing. So if you can help her in any way, why, she's very deserving of your help. Joan Dionne, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look forward to having you on again after the next big meeting.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. God bless you, and God bless America.
Bye-bye. God bless. Okay, fine. That was Joan Dionne. I hope you enjoyed the program. And of course, remember that they hold these meetings. Of course, they're trying to get support for what's going on over in Iraq. And things are not going well at all. In fact, as Donald Rumsfeld recently said, why that we seem to be creating more terrorists. We keep killing them, and we keep creating more and more terrorists. See, I wonder why. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I have to remind all of you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're primarily dependent upon you out there who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours every weekday and to 35 stations on the weekend, bringing the information, the news behind the news, the story behind the story. So if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like, of course, a free copy of our newsletter or a copy of the Earth Charter we talked about, which lays out the Ten Commandments. Of course, it's really 16 commandments, but Gorbachev calls it the Ten Commandments. You know that great humanitarian, Mikhail Gorbachev. He was the butcher of Afghanistan. He was the premier, the dictator of Russia at the time that they carried on the slaughter of the Afghans and dropped the bombs that would blow off the hands. They were shaped like toys, so the kids would pick them up not knowing that they were going to blow off their hands and feet. But there's no call for prosecution of Gorbachev because he wrote the Earth Charter along with Maurice Strong and Stephen Rockefeller. And, of course, the Earth Charter is made of 16 points. Number 10 talks about how, of course, we're going to have to redistribute the wealth within nations and redistribute the wealth between nations. If you'd like the whole plan, it has to do with environmentalism, world government, of course, population control, the whole scenario, the new spirituality, of course, and, of course, this whole thing comes right out of the pit of hell. But nobody's going to tell you that this whole move towards world government is the devil's own plan, and it's coming to fulfillment during our lifetime. So we hope that many of you will want to get our material. If you haven't read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to. We talked a little earlier about the Brahimi Report. That is included along with so much else from the Millennium Summit meeting that was held in the year 2000, where the plans for the world government were laid out, and we have going with that a four-tape set called Millennium Madness. We have a video that goes with that. So you need the information so you can understand what's going on. How do you understand what's going on today? Well, of course, you need to know the past. You need to understand what happened at the Millennium Summit. So there's a syllabus, a four-tape set, and a video. And then to understand what's going on, why we're in the war in Iraq, you need to get the video, Iraq, the Untold Story, and there's a syllabus that goes with that as well. And it gives you all the documentation, even the documentation for the project for the New American Century. Now, what is the project? Well, it's 25 people who got together in 1997 who decided to take over our government, men like Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, Liddy, Elliot Abrams, and the others, and they even put it, it's on their website, newamericancentury.org. You can look at it, newamericancentury.org. And in 1998, they were calling for the war with Iraq. But, of course, they're not going to tell you this, that there's a little group. And, of course, it's just by chance that 17 of the 25 original members of the group just by chance happened to come from the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a front for the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created back in 1891. That's all covered in Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, the book where they came in and bought up the publisher and destroyed the place in the first half of the book. And as I say, we have the interview with Professor Quigley in our secret government four tape set where you'll hear Professor Quigley telling how they suppressed his book. And Professor Quigley was a liberal college professor who taught at Princeton and Harvard before he went to Georgetown University. And his most famous student was a young man named William Jefferson Clinton. Well, you need, of course, to get the material available from Radio Liberty if you'd like to get our free newsletter. We'll send you a catalog, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. Pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. Please don't forget our website. It's radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. You can hear from us 5 hours a day there, by either directly or indirectly, or you can hear us on shortwave 4 hours a day. Please tell your friends and help us save America. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being because we have with us this evening, at least I hope, our good friend Joel Skousen, who is the editor and publisher of World Affairs Brief. And if you don't go to his website and get his material, it's excellent. It's just worldaffairsbrief.com, www.worldaffairsbrief.com. I go there every day. Today I wasn't able to pull down anything, but ordinarily there's all sorts of fascinating articles that is bring you right up to date on what's going on in the world. And when we last talked to Joel a few days ago, why he was pointing out that 10 of the flotillas that we have, 10 battle units of our fleet had been put to sea. Now we have 12 carrier groups, 10 of them are at sea. This has never happened before. And the question is raised, why did this happen? All of a sudden, this was not scheduled. Something big had come up. Of course, the Navy saying, oh, this is the most normal thing in the world. This has never happened before. And, well, we've got Joel Skousen with us right on the line. Hi, Joel. How are we doing?
Why, fine, Dr. Stan. Nice to be with you tonight. Sorry about the website being down today. It's coming back up. Just had a glitch, and everything got deleted on the daily news postings. But
that's all right. You know, I'll be back there again tomorrow. But it's an excellent website. You're doing a great job, and it's only been up for a couple of weeks. And I'll tell you, there's more fascinating material there than you'll find just about any other place.
Yes, and my researchers really do. They beat Drudge Report on many of the major stories. They're right on it early in the morning, and so you can get the top news. And it is screened. You know, we cover the tough stories, the ones that get very little play out there, and the ones that I think are important in terms of highlighting the ulterior agendas that much of our government and other people are involved in.
Well, of course, you know, I go to WorldNet Daily. I love WorldNet Daily. I love Joseph Farah. But, you know, you've got the summary of what the article is. You want to get it, they'll take you right to the website. If you don't want to, just want to read the summary, you go down to the next one. And I really like the way you have that website set up. And then, of course, you have all those suppressed stories over on the far right talking about what really happened with the murder of President Kennedy, what, of course, happened with the downing of what is it, Pan Am 103 or not, 103, and so many of the those stories that really need to be explored. And you've done a good job at getting that information there, because everything is cover up, lies and deception. Don't let the American people know what the truth is. They just can't handle the truth.
Well, that's what they say anyway. But we you know, those summaries that my researchers put up, that's something that I started several months ago when they were feeding me stories. You know, there were so many stories coming in, unless I got a summary of why they thought or what the key points were, it made it very difficult for me to have to open each one and look at them. And I find that visitors to the World Affairs Brief like that same thing, as you get a good summary and sometimes some critical comments about this being misinformation or disinformation, and it helps people sort through the news.
Well, I hope more and more people will be going there. That's worldaffairsbrief.com. First thing in the morning after I do my emails, I go to worldaffairsbrief.com. Well, tell us what the latest issues are that you're concerned about.
Well, I am concerned, and watching this, last week I gave a general alert out concerning all the many signs that we have a security problem in the United States. This shipping 10 carrier groups outside their home ports is something that's very rare. As you say, it hasn't been done since World War II. And there we should discuss some of the scenarios involved. Of course, the most dangerous scenario that is potential is the U.S. knows or has foreknowledge that there may be a major nuclear strike on America and wants to get their major military forces out of port in order to give them a better chance of success. There is also the potential that there is some kind of extraterrestrial asteroid or comet coming into the Earth that may throw some major asteroids. And there have been a lot of news lately about these meteors that are giving off strange signs that, frankly, aren't like any meteors that you or I have ever seen. Huge light flashes, and the kind that light up the entire sky at night, not just a streak, and then large explosion-like sounds. I have engineering friends that retired from Boeing that indicate very strongly this is probably testing of laser or particle beam weapons that are being experimented on to shoot down ballistic missiles as they're incoming, and they're using meteors as the test run. One of the particular interesting photos that came off of one of the security cameras, you see the meteor streaking across the sky, and the light flashes very brightly and lights up the entire parking lot of the security camera, but the light flash didn't come from the meteor streaking through the sky. That showed no increase in intensity. So you see, it indicates that there's something else going on here other than meteors, and that meteors are probably a cover story. lots of black budget weapons being developed. It wouldn't surprise me if this was one of those.
Okay, fine. Well, of course, there's a lot of uncertain things going on right at the present time. And one of the things that really disturbs me, Joel, is what's going on over in Saudi Arabia. As we pull our people out of there, British are pulling their people out, the whole economy is going to begin to grind to a stop, because I don't think the Saudis can run the oil of rigs and oil the all the mechanics over there without the help of the Americans and British. And this could have a real impact on their economy, and if they're shaky as it is, why, now they're blaming the Zionists for this, or the friends of the Zionists for all the attacks over there. Is it possible that there's going to be some real great earthquake over in Saudi Arabia, and the implosion of that corrupt society?
This is the third possible scenario for getting the fleet out of the ports that I was going to cover, and that is that there could be a major terrorist event in the world, potentially Saudi Arabia itself, of which the U.S. will have a designated country to blame immediately, just as they did after 9/11, where they blamed Afghanistan and then went after Iraq. They, I believe, have another country that they're planning on targeting, and it would be very, very convenient to have, and there are seven of those aircraft carrier groups are going to the Middle East, whereas only three are in the Far East. So I think the potential of something happening in and around the Saudi Arabia are very high. It is very suspicious now. For the second time within 2 weeks, the United States has given strict warnings for all Americans, to leave Saudi Arabia.
I never remember that before, do you?
No. And now they have given alerts to tourists, you know, to beware of going into Saudi Arabia or to Israel or to Egypt or other things. But to tell all Americans that they better get out of Saudi Arabia, I think they've got foreknowledge of something. Now, it's very important to understand that we're talking about, you know, in excess of 35,000 people. We're talking about a lot of infrastructure support that is coming from Americans and British and German technicians. As you said, I don't know how Saudi Arabia is going to get along without those technicians. As in most of these Arab countries, whether it's the power supply system or much of their sophisticated technology, they do sub those things out to other high-tech companies in the world, especially Europe and the United States. It's interesting that even though these oil companies in the United States were nationalized many years ago, these oil companies, through being subcontractors to the Saudi National Oil Company, have been able to reap, you know, millions of dollars in contracts, not as much as they would have, of course, if they'd retained actual ownership of the oil fields, but certainly they have not been left out in the cold. So this is an ominous sign that Saudi Arabia may well be destabilized. It will, of course, wouldn't this be convenient if it provided a real excuse, a wonderful excuse to President Bush to tell the American people, now look at what's happening in Saudi Arabia. Aren't we fortunate to have 14 military bases in Iraq and 145,000 troops there so that we can come to the support of the Saudi government instantaneously?
It's almost like somebody has written a script, isn't it?
It is. Meanwhile, Iran is scurrying to put their nuclear program underground, I mean physically. A report from Debka.com is very, very, he got an advanced leak out of the upcoming report from the International Atomic Energy Commission, a report on Iranian concealment, and I'll quote from this, it's rather dramatic. Our intelligence sources reveal exclusively that when inspectors arrived in Iran in mid-May and asked to revisit installations they saw in February, they were astonished to find empty spaces. When they questioned the Iranian escorts, they were greeted with blank stares. What installations, the officials asked. Inspectors pulled out photos from previous visits and showed the Iranian officials what had been there before, and they shrugged their shoulders and said, oh, these must be photographs of some different place.
Well, is Debka Mossad, a friend for the Mossad, do you think?
No, not directly.
Not indirectly.
I know Gyor Shamis, who runs Debka. I met with him in Israel last time I was there, and I asked him point blank. I said, Gyor, where are your sources coming from? I mean, I'm in the private intelligence business. I can't get this kind of information. And he said, they're all from government sources.
All right, so at least the government is leaking that information to them. When you leak information, usually it's information you want to get out.
Well, that's right. And, you know, he's a two-man shop. There's just no way that he can check out whether or not it's disinformation. And, frankly, his record is rather spotty. A lot of the things that he's printed have not become true from subsequent investigation. But some of his analysis is very good. Now, let there be no mistake about it. Gyor Shamis is a very savvy analyst. I think that he allows himself to be used for planted stories by various government agencies around the world. But he's no schlock analyst, too, so it's worthy of reading. But you have to be pretty sophisticated to be able to see through the bad stuff versus the good stuff.
Well, that's why we depend on you to do that. Now, one of the things that bothers me are the stories we've heard that Saudi Arabia has a certain number of missiles that are with nuclear tips somewhere in the desert and has a lot of Chinese there that to make them work. Apparently, the Chinese missiles and, of course, the nuclear warheads from Pakistan. Do you think there's any truth to that story?
I do, just because China supplies all the technology to Pakistan, so there is a seamless connection there between Pakistan and China. So the missiles that Pakistan just tested, for example, that are supposed to be nuclear capable, are very much a very similar signature to the Chinese missiles that they're exporting.
Well, now, if there really are nuclear-tipped missiles there in Saudi Arabia, and that government looks shaky as if it might fall, we would have no choice but to move into Saudi Arabia to keep them from falling into the hands of Al-Qaeda. At least this is what we would tell the American people.
Well, I'm not sure that they would actually admit that Saudi Arabia has nuclear missiles. I frankly feel that the most likely scenario is there would be a major attack on oil production and refining capabilities there in Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. would enter to protect the Saudi regime. They may well do that openly, but I don't think they would mention the fact, even though the U.S. knows that the Saudis do have missiles. I don't believe that they would mention that publicly.
In other words, they wouldn't tell the American people because we wouldn't understand.
That's right. We don't understand anything, of course.
Well, right. All right, fine. Well, of course, it looks like things are really heating up there. It sounds like they're going to be pulling 14,000 and 15,000 troops out of Korea. They're pulling troops out of Europe. Have you heard where they're going to be sending those troops?
Well, certainly we know that 15,000 to 20,000 more troops are going directly to Iraq. So, and that's what some of our soldiers in Korea have been told. You're going to get a change of scenery. No more cold winters.
All right. But, of course, the tragedy is there's so many of these young people who have signed up for a specific period of time. They signed a contract. The government promised them they could get out at a certain time, and then they changed their mind. Isn't that creating a lot of unrest and a lot of bitterness on the part of some of these young people over there?
Well, I don't think that anyone's allowed to speak freely on that point. But after these people are released, I think they're going to exit en masse. They're certainly embittered, I think, at the deception of government. Of course, the government is calling up the inactive reserves now. They do have a contractual obligation. The inactive reserves have not been used since World War II. And, this is certainly not a national emergency by any means. It just shows the weakened state that our military is, and we have to tap the inactive reserve to start filling some of these slots. The United States continues to brag about how they're meeting all their recruitment goals. You notice they never do publish any results about what percentage of people are staying or leaving. They just say, we've got 110% of our recruitment goal. Well, you see, they could have cut their recruitment goal in half to declare a success story of 110%. That's like the stock market pundits who keep saying, Intel did better than expected, so the whole market was higher today. Well, what do you mean did better than expected? That could be manipulated so easily by simply understating the expectations and then having a success story.
That's like we're doing better here in California and our test scores for schools, but they've dumbed down the test so that. And of course, my concern is they're probably going to have the draft next year. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that they'll be careful. They're testing the water right now, Dr. Stan, and I don't believe that the nation is ready for a draft. I think that it's a very real possibility only if you have a major terrorist event. I think if you have a strike on Saudi Arabia and another widening of the Middle East war, you're going to have a draft.
Okay.
But I don't think, short of that, that they'll have the political muscle to do that. You know, speaking of manipulation statistics, I covered in this week's World Affairs Brief as well to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who does the CPI, which is grossly understated, is also starting to manipulate the PPI. Now, the PPI is the Producer's Price Index. This is a precursor of inflation because it tells you what all of the purchasing agents and major corporations are buying. I covered a couple weeks before that the fact that purchasing agents are experiencing price increases in all the raw commodities for industry. And this has apparently been confirmed by several others. And suddenly, we get a message from the Bureau of Labor Statistics saying, and I quote, "The Producer Price Index for May 2004, scheduled for release on June 11th, has been postponed until further notice. BLS staff are working to resolve the unexpected difficulties in calculating the index for this month."
In fact, it's the first time I ever remember doing that. That must be pretty complicated, or do you think it might just possibly be they don't want the American people to realize it's going up so rapidly?
Well, Stan, the Producer's Price Index has been easy to calculate because there's nothing to calculate. You simply add up the various prices and check the average against the previous year, and you publish the results. When they say working to resolve unexpected difficulties in calculating the index, they're saying unexpected inflation that we don't know how to deal with. We can't cover it for it like we do in the CPI. All you have to do is remove anything that's offensive to the government out of the basket of goods that the so-called typical American uses. So if gas prices go up, they say, well, the poor person that we're dealing with, that we have as a typical American, isn't buying any gas anymore because he's taking the bus.
I understand that they've taken a lot of the food out of that as well.
What they do is they take one high-priced item out and they switch it to another that isn't growing as fast. And so even with the manipulation, the CPI is showing about a 4% rate of inflation. I think the rate is topping 10% now.
This is what I hear from my sources as well. But, of course, what's that old saying? Figures never lie, but liars can sure figure. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes here with Joel Skousen, editor of World Affairs Brief, bringing you up to date on what's really going on in the world. The information you're not going to get from Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw. We'll be back here in just a moment. To pursue a close look at what's really going on in the world. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. And if really we are in an inflationary spiral, why the Fed's going to have to raise interest rates, which is going to, of course, to threaten the stability of the housing bubble, is going to, eventually have a real impact on certainly borrowing money, certainly industry is going to begin to falter. Other than the war industries, defense industries, I don't think any of our industries are really that healthy, are they?
Well, some of them are and some of them aren't. The ones that in the military industrial complex is doing very well right now. Ones that have a big foot in the airline industry, such as Boeing, are not doing very well, especially since there's been the big scandal over the so-called leasing agreement for tanker aircraft that was going to cost, almost many billions as if you bought the aircraft. Boeing, of course, has a very insidious relationship within government. They do their bidding. Boeing does an awful lot of defense contracting in joint partnership with Zvezdostrela, the weapons lab of the Soviet Union, the continuing Soviet Union. This means that the Russians have access to the secret plans for the joint strike fighter that the U.S. is developing. And that allows the U.S. to surreptitiously transfer much military technology to Russia, calling them, of course, our allies. In the meantime, of course, unilateral disarmament continues to go forth, even though the Russians continue to back out of the ones they signed, the Intermediate Forces Treaty. They lied about. There were no sanctions for that. They just backed out of the treaties stating they were going to dismantle their rest of their SS-18s. They say they're not going to do that until 2012 to 2020. They need it because they feel insecure. The U.S. is continuing to dismantle its MXs. And the Bush administration just announced this past week that it has sent to Congress a classified plan to reduce the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile by almost half, leaving a maximum of 2,200 deployed warheads and thousands of others in reserve. Now, of course, the U.S. had as many as 7,000 strategic warheads and smaller tactical warheads, as much as 2,000, and 3,000 reserve warheads. The fact, though, is that the American taxpayer is still paying to dismantle what missiles and warheads they do dismantle from Russia. All those warheads go back into Russia's strategic stockpile, into a very secure facility built by U.S. engineers, and U.S. Inspectors are not allowed to inspect inside that facility now that it is complete. So we don't know how many missiles they've got, how many warheads they have. Everything that the United States says publicly about the state of arms in Russia is taken exactly from international treaties on disarmament. In other words, the U.S. is playing the game as if Russia is in 100% compliant, even though Russia has said, we will not be compliant. Now, isn't that phenomenal?
Well, I think even more phenomenal is the American people were willing to go along with doing away with our warheads and unilateral disarmament in return for building 20 interceptors. In other words, the Russians probably have 8,000 to 10,000 missiles, and we built 20 interceptors, which probably won't work. That's not a very good deal, and yet the American people say, well, as long as we have a defense now, we finally built a defense. Even though we don't know it's going to work, because we have to hit a missile with a missile, but, you know, at least now we can go ahead and unilaterally disarm safely. You wonder if there really is intelligent life on Earth. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Joel Skousen, and please, Joel, go right ahead.
One of the things that has disturbed me relative to disarmament and covering for the Russians, I do get a lot of flack from people who complain that when I say that the U.S. is covering for Russia, they really have learned to believe this propaganda that the Soviet Union fell, that Reagan was successful in getting Gorbachev to tear down that wall, Mr. Gorbachev. I found it rather disturbing and rather strange that the universal world, including the establishment liberal media, has given such praiseworthy eulogies for weeks at a time to President Ronald Reagan. Now, I was in Washington as chairman of the Conservative National Committee during the Reagan administration. I went back there and took that job specifically to help counter the very poor compromises that the Reagan administration was making. We lost a lot of ground for liberty. We lost a lot of ground in taxes, even though he started out with a tax cut, he ended up giving us the largest tax increase we've ever had through the major Social Security tax, which essentially doubled the Social Security tax. That's why we're paying 15% of our income in addition to the income tax, in addition to the state income tax, for things that adds up to over 50%. Now, Reagan himself, in my opinion, was not a conspirator. He was not part of the club. They did not intend him to win the Republican election, but they knew that if he did, he was a controllable entity. They had successfully controlled him in California, got him under the leverage of pressure and threat of media blackballing and criticism to bend his arm many, many times, and he in turn bent other arms like State Congressman Richardson, who you're familiar with, who became very active in the gun cause. He sat down and told me one day how he had spent a half an hour with Governor Reagan just railing and raking him over the coals because of not willing to compromise on a gun issue for California. And he kept going through all the arguments, the press is going to crucify us, the liberals are going to crucify us. And he said, so what? This is a matter of principle. We've got to stand on this. And Reagan wouldn't buy it. He said, you know, above all, we have to maintain political power in this state. And that's the kind of pragmatist that Reagan really was. And part of that was because of Nancy, his wife, and an avid astrologer watcher. And both Nancy and Ron Reagan did engage in astrology as some of their leading guidance. They did play lip service to God. And the Christian Coalition and other of their allies, but they also played lip service the next day to speeches to the American Society of Broadcasters and the Public Education Union. So you see, Reagan really wanted to be something to all peoples. But it is very strange that the establishment media and liberals have praised him so openly. I suspect what they're doing is that Reagan's legacy is a very useful thing to getting people to continue to support the Bush administration. That is, you give the image that you are powerful and strong in moving about the world, asserting your will, and you get these wonderful benefits like the fall of communism, the fall of tyranny in Iraq. And I think they're jumping on that bandwagon and using Reagan to be able to continue to keep conservatives in that ballpark. Now, in contrast, on the WhiteHouse.gov website, you will find the eulogy that President Bush just gave this past week to Bill and Hillary Clinton as they unveiled their portraits to go in the White House gallery for the president. You wouldn't believe the effusive compliments about how wonderful President Clinton was, what a wonderful, bright spirit he brought to the White House, what integrity he brought to the White House. And, you know, you may say, well, he was just being diplomatic. Well, there's a difference between being diplomatic and just effusive in your praise. It's very obvious that these are team players on the same team, in my opinion.
That's a very hard thing for the average individual to accept, Joel, except, you know, if you remember when Bush first came in the White House, why he left all of those terrible, terrible executive orders that Bill Clinton had put in, many of them just immediately before he left because they were so controversial. And yet George Bush could have simply negated them all, and he left almost every one of those executive orders, including the one where we would absorb a first nuclear strike. We would not retaliate it until our cities were in ashes or our weapons were destroyed. And there were so many things that Bill Clinton did that George Bush could have undone, and instead of undoing it, he said, well, let's just go on from here. And, of course, it seems like continuing down the steady downward spiral towards the destruction of America. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen. And you have to ask yourself, is there really a lot of difference? I mean, Bill Clinton never had the deficits such as the Republicans had. Bill Clinton never could have gotten Ted Kennedy's education bill through, but George Bush did. Bill Clinton never could have gotten a Medicare funding bill through that expand Medicare, but George Bush did. Is this really the work of a conservative? Well, Joel, go right ahead there.
Well, I'd like to switch gears a little bit and move on to the Middle East and talk about the issue on Israel relative to the unilateral withdrawal from the Gaza settlements. A lot of people don't realize that there are 21 cities and towns in the Gaza Strip that belong to Israeli settlers. And these are not just towns, but these are industries as well. Most of the greenhouses in Israel are in the Gaza area by the coast, produce most of the kosher foods for importation into the eastern half of the United States. The continued insistence of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon in abandoning these 21 major Israeli settlements in the Gaza without demanding a cessation of violence, note that, or any concessions at all from the Palestinian terrorists is really unwise and suicidal at best. You know, what's interesting, Dr. Stanley, this is strangely reminiscent of the perennial efforts by George Bush to grant continued amnesty to Mexican illegal aliens, you know, which only induces a greater impetus for illegal immigration. Both of these policies, the Sharon policy of simply giving up whole cities, now these are not just, you know, they talk about these as settlements. Well, these aren't just tents or trader parks or temporary housing. I've been to these settlements. I've been to Gush Katif and many of the other areas there in the Gaza. And these are beautiful homes that would look just like they were in California or any other coastal community, with tile roofs and beautiful gardens and palm trees and other things. And much of these have been built with loans from U.S. taxpayers. Beautiful, pristine industries in these. And they're going to walk away and turn all of these over to the very people who've been throwing mortars at these communities for years. Now, people have died. They've sacrificed their lives in defending these communities. And all of a sudden, Ariel Sharon wants to leave them, as if, he says, we're going to start peace, restart peace talks. What he's really doing is, first of all, he's unilaterally creating a Palestinian state by removing the Israeli settlers, so that even though they haven't qualified for a Palestinian state in terms of cessation of violence, he's doing it in the name of, you know, we're proving to the world that we're going to unilaterally do this to eliminate all the causes of violence, and we're going to give them their state anyway. This was reinforced, by the way, at the G8 summit, where world leaders, especially the Quartet, Russia, the European Union, the United States, and the UN, got together and reaffirmed the roadmap plan. Now, the roadmap is just essentially a giveaway like Ariel Sharon is trying to do, but the roadmap was derailed by a series of terrorist events that made it untenuous for Israel to proceed.
Hold that thought right there.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and he's talking about the what's going on over in Israel, as Israel is unilaterally pulling its settlements out of Gaza and not asking for anything in return. Now, why would you give up these very valuable settlements there and displace all these Israeli citizens in return for absolutely nothing? So why don't you sort of pick up the story from there, Joel? What Sharon is doing is certainly a treasonous at best, and at worst, why, it's something far, far even more sinister. But go ahead.
Well, you know, these latest maneuvers really are a blatant attempt by Sharon to destroy the heart and the soul of Aliyah. Now, Aliyah is a Hebrew word meaning returning to Israel. It really technically means ascent or progress, advance in immigration to Israel, as a symbol of taking one's Jewish life to a higher level. That's why they use Aliyah or ascent. You ascend into Israel from your dispersed status among the world. Now, building settlements, actually modern cities, for these new settlers is, of course, an essential part of building Israel. There is no homeland for the Jews if there's no room for new settlers. And the Israeli settlers, sad but notable exceptions during and after the war on independence, have always built their settlements on purchased land, purchased from the Arabs, or unowned land. Now, there were a couple of or a few settlements that were the Arab leaders themselves forced their own Arab people to leave during the war of independence, and there are indications, even though the Israeli government denies this, where the Israelis drove out the Arabs out of threat of their lives and took over their land. This provides the basis for both the illegitimate and the legitimate claims of the refugees in terms of wanting the land back in Israel. Of course, now it's been so many years, it's almost impossible to get back land that has become totally productive through other people's efforts. But certainly compensation should be paid to those families, you know, who were illegitimately driven out of their homes in the War of Independence. But, of course, that isn't the whole purpose. The whole purpose of the refugee crisis and the Arab countries keeping these refugees cooped up in refugee camps and not allowing them to be absorbed naturally into other Arab countries is specifically to use them as political cannon fodder in the ongoing negotiations with Israel. They really want to, if they can't defeat Israel militarily, they want to force upon them the return of about 3.5 million Arab refugees. And these aren't really the refugees anymore. These are the sons and the grandchildren and daughters of those refugees, which really haven't been aggrieved directly. And but essentially they want to overwhelm Israelis in the voting of their own leaders so that they can take over the country in that way. But, you know, let me go back to the case of the unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, because here's a recap of the bizarre transition of Sharon from supporter of settlements to betrayer of settlements. Note this, for years Sharon championed and fought for the right of settlers to occupy raw, unclaimed land in the occupied territories. He often claimed, and by the way, this is necessary, you can't really have a homeland for the Jews in Israel proper, the way that they've been forced to into this small strip of land, which is approximately 5 miles across and 15 miles tall.
I think for our listeners, Joel, they really must understand that Israel has given up between 95 and 97% of the land that they had after, you know, prior to the onset of the Oslo Accord and these other negotiations that were going to bring peace. And if Israel would just give up the land, why then there'd be peace? Well, Israel gave up the land and gave up between 95 and 97% of the land. And, of course, the Palestinian leaders had no intention of bringing about peace. And we're funding Arafat. We're funding the Islamic people that right there. We've trained many of the military there for use not to, you know, keep the Palestinians in line, but to go against the Israelis. We're funding both sides. This is what's so incredible.
Yes, and that shows, this is very typical of the Hegelian conflict, where you fund both sides to create future conflict. Case in point is the return of the Sinai Peninsula, won during the 67 war, to Egypt. And Egypt claims to have a peaceful relationship with Egypt, but it's only superficial. Egypt has continued to arm. All of the military forces in Egypt are planning for a future strike on Israel. That's the typical war game scenario that they use. They are responsible for shipping to the communities in Egypt right across the border from the lower southern Gaza Strip. They have all 10 or 20 tunnels, major tunnels. You can drive trucks through these tunnels, some of these tunnels, between Gaza City in Egypt and Gaza proper in Israel. And that's what these latest operations were of the Israeli Defense Forces in southern Gaza, of which they pulled out without completing the job, obviously from pressure from the United States in that regard. But you see, what I want to make the point about the transition of Sharon and how he's morphed, and I'm not sure he really was morphed, I think he always was a puppet of the globalists and just playing the right wing, just like Benjamin Netanyahu is playing a right wing role to the right of Ariel Sharon, but he's a Kissinger protege, and as soon as he gets to be prime minister, he starts to compromise just like Sharon does. So, you know, there's no defense against, when you don't believe in conspiracy, as most Jews don't, there's no defense against this kind of deception when you really want to believe what people are telling you. But Sharon's record is really quite abysmal when it comes to breaking his red lines. Now, red lines in Israel means you draw a line in the sand, and this is a red line, something that Sharon has promised never to cross. And one of those red lines was, I will never give up any Israeli settlements. He said that on numerous occasions. So at first, after the remember he went, as I covered several weeks ago, he submitted when he found out that his withdrawal plan was just causing a firestorm within his own Likud party, that's the Israeli version of the Republican Party. He agreed to abide by a referendum. If the party said, we'll reject the withdrawal plan, then I won't do it. He would concede. But as it turned out, he was just playing for time. A new news campaign was launched, and by the way, the referendum went against Sharon by an overwhelming margin. A news campaign was launched in the liberal press attacking Sharon's acceptance of the results. If Israel's fate was being controlled by a single party. So they're making the point, Sharon, you represent all of Israel, not just the Likud parties. You cannot be bound by your own political party. This is ludicrous because when Labor Party is in power or when Clinton is in party, he's bound by the Democratic Party. And he doesn't represent the United States. It's winner take all. That's one of the problems with a democracy. But in any case, this allowed Sharon to respond with courage, so to speak, to abandon his obligations to his party's principles. He announced he would not then abide by the vote, but he would come up with a compromise. He said, I'm going to withdraw only from 3 towns instead of 21. The next day he waffled even more and said that he would withdraw from the others later, if approved by the cabinet. Now, the cabinet set about to say, we're not going to approve that. And when they put it up for a referendum, he was going to lose this. And so what did he do this last week? He dismissed two of his own right-wing cabinet ministers. Didn't dismiss any liberals, just his own right-wing cabinet ministers, Transportation Minister Lieberman and Tourism Minister Benny Alone, two hardcore campaigners against the withdrawal from Gaza. So, you see, he's just really playing the system. Now, the dismissal of the National Union Party ministers, both those were this small right-wing coalition partner, this came, of course, right before he presented the vote to the cabinet. The cabinet approved by a majority of one vote his staged withdrawal from Israel. So he is still planning on withdrawing from all 21 communities, only in stages. He is offering all of the settlers $300,000 to leave their homes. This exceeds the value of any one of those homes there. So in essence, he's bribing them. The settlers are not about to take a bribe. A lot of them are putting up signs in front of the houses, "We will not be bought." This looks like it's going to be a major confrontation if these settlers decide they're going to fight their own military when they try to remove them by force.
But, of course, will the own Israeli military fire on Israeli citizens? I would certainly hope not.
Well, they don't fire on them, so to speak, but they go and manhandle them, beat them with clubs and handcuff them and drag them off, and they're used to doing that because Israeli settlers have been a tough bunch, so have the Russian immigrants, too, on these more rudimentary settlements that are not legal. They just go out and camp on raw land and start building a settlement, drill a well, and the soldiers have regularly been going in and removing them. So there is a precedent set, but I tell you, we're talking about some 14 or 15,000 people. If they all decide to protest en masse, I don't think it's going to happen. Nobody's got the political will to be bashing that many heads in Israel, especially of your best settlers. Now, today I will note that just hit the news wires that the Israeli Supreme Court has refused to indict Ariel Sharon on corruption charges. He's been a very corrupt leader, passing out goodies among his sons and real estate developers, just like Bush has been doing for Halliburton and other corporations. And, of course, in Israel, he controls the powers that be, control the court system, just as they do in the United States. And so we do get predictable results. I noted with interest as well this year, or this month, switching topics, that the Supreme Court evaded a real definitive ruling on the Pledge of Allegiance. They simply ruled on procedural grounds, which was outrageous, that the father, representing the daughter, simply because he did not have full custody of the daughter, had no legal right to represent her interests. You know, since when does a full-blood father, not have the right to represent any of his daughter's interests just because of a court ruling that he doesn't have technical custody?
Well, I think
he has visiting rights. He's not prohibited from seeing the child. A father that has visiting rights has no right to represent anything about his daughter's legal situation. That's incredulous.
Well, of course, the other thing is, though, apparently she's a Christian, the mother's a Christian, and they, of course, oppose the father. And so who is he really representing? Was he really representing the child, or was this his own agenda? So,
But the point I'm making, it's not that, I don't care what the family's thing was. This was really a an evasive thing on the Supreme Court. They did not want to rule in favor directly of the Pledge of Allegiance. So they took the procedural route and said he has no cause to bring forth suit.
Well, of course, we, here the Supreme Court starts every session when the choir comes in, as he always has for 200 years, and says, "God save the United States and this honorable court." Now, they start every session of the Supreme Court with that, and yet the Supreme Court has ruled, of course, that the God and mention of God is illegal in our schools, and then dodges this issue. We got real trouble. We've got people in the Supreme Court who don't believe in our Constitution, who do not believe in our way of life, and who are frankly anti-Christian.
And the rest that pretending to be conservative Christians are really probably not so. I mean, we have Justice Thomas, who the charges of sexual abuse and other things are true as far as my research is concerned. They had this hanging over his head, and he'll play the conservative role, but on crucial votes, we lose. They always have this way of voting 5-4, but there are other people as well, like Scalia, you know, who has said some very egregious things. Of course, his big buddies with Vice President Dick Cheney, who's a knowing conspirator, in my opinion, George Bush's handler in the presidency. So I don't really trust the Supreme Court conservatives are really conservative either. I don't think anybody, frankly, can get on the Supreme Court if they're truly a constitutional conservative.
Well, at least not today. Well, let's go to Dale, who's calling in. Hi, Dale. Do you have a quick question?
Yes, a quick question. Apparently what's happening is part of a globalist agenda, and I'm curious, Mr. Skousen, if you're aware of any particular globalist agenda that it appears the Israelite Prime Minister is following.
All right, that's a very legitimate question. You want us to take that on the air or want us to stay on?
I'll just take it on the air there.
Okay,
thank you.
Fine.
Yes, the globalist agenda is this. There has been an unwritten agenda behind all of the peace plans. All of the peace plans presented at Israel require that Israel pull back from the occupied territories, which means they lose all of the strategic high ground for their military forces. The U.S. is already using taxpayer money to rebuild bases within the smaller confined area, the 5-by-15-mile area of Israel. But that really is quite indefensible. You also lose about 60% of Israel's water rights for most of their farms and agricultures in the occupied territories as well. So in answer to your question, the globalist agenda is to destabilize Israel militarily, not to appear to be an outright giveaway of Israeli sovereignty, but simply to destabilize it and weaken its military and strategic position, that in the next war, which all of the Arab countries are preparing for, which will involve a barrage of missiles that will overwhelm their Arrow anti-ballistic missile system, they want to set Israel up so that they must call upon outside help, notably the United Nations or the U.S. or the European Union, to come in and save them in the next war. This will provide the United Nations the opportunity to come in and implant a Kosovo-style caretaker government, as we have in Afghanistan and we're moving towards in Iraq. That's the purpose of the globalist agenda, is to attack countries that value their sovereignty and come in and bring caretaker puppet-like governments over them, as the U.S. is installing in Iraq, so they really don't have true sovereignty anymore. At least that's how I view Sharon falling into that same plan of the EU and the U.S. pushing these peace plans, which are not peace plans, simply compromises aimed at reducing Israeli military superiority.
And, of course, I sort of look at this from a spiritual point of view as well. There is no way that Israel can possibly survive without God's intervention. And, of course, since these other people really don't believe God's going to intervene, I think that they're setting Israel up to be destroyed. But, you know, I do believe that God does have a plan for Israel, just as he has a plan for other countries and for each and every one of us. And I think it's going to be incredibly, fascinating to see how this plays out. You were talking about Egypt before. We provide something like $3 billion a year for Egypt, and Egypt spend most of the money on developing weapons so that they can eventually attack Israel. What's wrong with this scenario? We give money to Israel to protect itself. We give money to Egypt and to Arafat so that they can get the weapons to attack Israel. And yet, of course, I believe that we're going to see an unfolding of an amazing story there, within the next few years.
And it's also notable that Egypt is starting to purchase, once again, weapons from Russia. Now, this seems to indicate that they know that once they attack Israel in the next war, that the U.S. will have to cut off weapons to Egypt, and so they want to be able to fall back to their former Soviet supply department.
In fact, the Soviets are working very closely with Iran. They certainly were working very closely with Iraq before we took it down. They've been working very closely with Syria. The Soviets have their hand in everything there in the Middle East. And yet, of course, we continue directly and indirectly funding the Soviets, which in many respects doesn't make sense unless there's another agenda behind everything going on.
And we have to remember that Russia is trying to keep a low profile, so they do use surrogates to transfer their military technology and use of advisors. China's their primary surrogate, as well as India and Pakistan are surrogates of Russia and China. And North Korea, of course, has been always a surrogate. All of these countries are working in Syria. to upgrade its biological and chemical warfare programs. They have possession of weapons of mass destruction from Iraqi arsenals, which the U.S. has known about for years. And, of course, they will bring this up and emphasize it when it's time to attack Syria. But for now, that's still in the offing.
Of course, I keep wondering if they're going to find those weapons of mass destruction maybe in October, just before the November elections. We'll have to wait and see. But, you know, everything I have read from so many other points has confirmed what you told me, oh, probably 6 to 9 months ago. And that was, of course, that Saddam Hussein had moved his weapons of mass destruction to Syria. Our government knew it and was not telling the American people. Which, of course, is incredible, because if they were to come out and say that, that would vindicate George Bush's statements. Yes, there were weapons of mass destruction. When they saw we were coming in, they got rid of them, you know, and so it's so good we went in there. But, of course, they're not putting the information out, which almost makes it look like they're trying to discredit George Bush. There's so many imponderables here. I don't wish I had the answer to all the questions that I have.
That is an interesting conundrum. I mean, it's like the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. Obviously, CBS is a controlled establishment news entity, would not have released those photos had the U.S. wanted to keep the lid on it. After all, everyone's known about this prison scandal in the sense that these kinds of abuse had been going on clear through 2003 and even beyond. The policy of stripping prisoners naked out in the field, I've got pictures dating back to 2003 on that. So this has been something that you can't say to me that the embedded reporters didn't see this happening. They were the one taking a lot of the photographs, but obviously those photographs never hit the American news wires until they wanted this released. I think this is part of the larger agenda. This is in answer to your caller's question about what is the globalist agenda. There's the larger one is the antagonizing of the Arab and Islam and Slavic world, so as to justify the real axis of evil, Russia and China, to attack the United States in a preemptive nuclear strike. And that is what I think the globalists want. Why would they want to attack the engine of prosperity? Why would they want to attack the United States? Well, first of all, the globalist New World Order cannot go forward unless someone takes down and removes the U.S. as the policeman of the world. Who's going to put their money behind a world army under the U.N. as long as the U.S. is doing the policing in the world? So once you remove that, and then our leaders come out of their own bunkers and say the Russians deceived us, our only hope now is to join forces with the United Nations in beating this great axis of evil. And we'll do it in the name of God, country, and the Constitution with all the typical knee-jerk patriotism. But I want to warn those with children who are anxious to go do their duty in the military that they will be sacrificed in a horrible nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare of which we will not be prepared, of which we are supposed to lose from the U.S. point of view, and that they'll be sacrificed in the name of a United Nations war. They should be prepared to resist sending their sons into the military into the future, because they're not working for U.S. liberty and sovereignty, even though that's, of course, what they euphemistically tell the public.
Well, we're out of time, and I think on that cheerful note, we're going to let you go. Let's get that website out, please, and how people can get in touch with you.
The website is worldaffairsbrief.com, and if they don't have access to the web, they can call an 800 number. It's 877. That's toll-free, 877-518-5888, and that's courtesy of Midas Resources. They will send out a complimentary copy of the latest print edition of the World Affairs Brief, and you can call from there with a number that will be given you to subscribe to my publisher.
And why don't you get that 800 number just one more time, because they never get it the first time.
Right. It's 877-518-5888, 5888. That's for a complimentary copy of the latest print edition of the World Affairs Brief.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Joel. It's always a pleasure, and you always certainly give us a lot to think about. God bless you. We'll look forward to talking to you later this week on one of our other programs.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed Joel Skousen. It's always very provocative, and I really feel we're on the edge of something big. I don't know what it is, but I hope and pray that if wrong about the Saudi government beginning to implode, Saudi Arabia beginning to implode, or we're going to have to send more troops over there to intervene. These are difficult times. we live in. And this is the time when, if you don't have a personal relationship with the Lord, you better start thinking about it, because the only thing I think that's going to get any of us through what lies ahead is, of course, giving our life to the Lord and coming to rely upon Him for our protection and for our provision. So we ask those of you out there in the listening audience to give serious consideration to that and realize again that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. This is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty, my ministry, is primarily listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And to do that, you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, we'd be glad to send you one. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com, and you can see all the various books and videos and audio tapes we have. We have all sorts of newsletters there. You're welcome to pull down and copy, and you can listen to our programs live 5 hours a day there on that website, either there or the websites, other websites that carry our live programs 5 hours a day. You won't get much accomplished, but you'll get a lot of information. Listen to a couple of hours a day if you possibly can. If you miss the programs, at least the Radio Liberty programs are archived there, and you can listen to those at any time you want to. If you don't like sitting in front of the computer, why, Radio Shack has some earphones that you can put on, and a little transmitter on the computer. You can go anywhere in the house. We actually have a little radio you can actually hook up to your computer. It's a transmitter, and you can then have an FM radio go any place in the house with that. Works very well. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if the American people don't turn back to God, why, I fear for the future of our country. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, because certainly our ministers should be leading the spiritual battle. And lastly, we ask you to remember my ministry, Radio Liberty. Please pray for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be with you once again, I guess Thursday evening, this is Dr. Stan saying goodnight, and may the Lord be with you.